and lively, intelligent interviews. I hear you asking, Mike, how can I stay sane in the age of Trump? No problem. Just listen to my show. It's all natural, gluten-free, and just plain good radio. That's Mike Fader with The Turning Point every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, right here on PRN.FM. I wish I could say all the
things. People are talking, talking. Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. My guest today is Daniel Ellsberg, best known as the whistleblower who released the Pentagon Papers and helped end the Vietnam War. An honors student at Harvard, where he earned a PhD, Daniel Ellsberg became a strategic analyst at the RAND Corporation and consultant to the Defense Department and the White House. He worked on the top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, which came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. Concerned about lies being told to the American people about the war, he had a change of heart, and in 1969 photocopied and released the study, an act of courage that helped end the Vietnam War. He wrote about his remarkable life in an autobiography titled Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. He is the subject of two Academy Award-nominated movies, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, from 2010, and more recently, The Post, starring Meryl Streep. We met in the 1980s through the peace movement and have been friendly ever since. Along with the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg copied other secret documents that he considers even more important on U.S. plans for nuclear war that he helped to write. He tells how we are in imminent danger from the nuclear threat, which could wipe out humanity, and shows us a way to prevent disaster in his amazing new book called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. It is these new revolutions that we will talk about today. Daniel Ellsberg, welcome back to All Together Now.
Glad to be here, Eleanor. Good.
Yeah, it looks like you're going to be a hero once again by telling us not just about the Vietnam War, but now about these nuclear weapons threats. So you released the Pentagon Papers and helped end the Vietnam War, but those papers were only a fraction of the 15,000 secret documents you copied from your high-level position in government. What was in the other documents you copied that we're now just learning about?
Well, the substance of those other documents, which were my own notes from years of work on nuclear command and control and nuclear war planning and nuclear crises, which were in my top secret safe at the RAND Corporation, it was my intention to put them out really as soon as the Pentagon Papers had whatever effect they might have in shortening the Vietnam War. And in particular, once I was put on trial, I expected those to come out after the outcome of that trial, or conceivably even earlier. But unfortunately, I'd given them to my brother in New York to store for me separately from the other papers, and he had ultimately, after moving them several times, buried them in a bluff in a trash dump in Tarrytown, New York, marked by a green iron stove over them so he could tell where they were. A hurricane, Tropical Storm Doria, actually then moved to that stove more than 100 yards, not clear in what direction, really, from the original position. The contents of the bluff spilled over onto the road and down a hill, and ultimately, after a year and a half of trying on weekends to find the box that contained those papers, my brother had to give up, essentially, and I had to recognize that they would not come out. I did try to get the substance, which is represented in this book, The Doomsday Machine, into print right after the war ended in 1975. But at that point, my then publisher said there was no chance of selling more than, as she put it, 1,400 copies, which meant that they would not publish it. And I took that as indication that I couldn't get it published elsewhere. And I really set out on an effort that occupied me most of my time in the next 40 years or so, which was trying to help build an anti-nuclear movement that would be comparable to the anti-war movement and might get us away from these extremely dangerous postures and plans and threats. And there was some success at various points in that, in movements against testing, but in the nuclear weapons, bilateral nuclear weapons freeze campaign aimed at getting U.S. and Russia mutually to stop adding to their forces or modernizing them. And in the end, with the end of the Cold War, most people thought the problem had gone away, which again reduced any interest in publishing material on this, as I found. But the fact is that the problem hasn't gone away. And when I set out to do it again, and Bloomsbury this time did pick up that that story from me after 17 other publishers had turned it down for commercial reasons, their expectation they couldn't market it. Bloomsbury went ahead with it, not knowing, of course, that Trump was going to become president and re-arouse people's fears about the possibility of nuclear war. Now, those fears are not unrealistic. They're realistic, and people are right to be concerned. But the problem did not start with Trump, and it won't end with Trump. It may be that he has attracted attention that will at last get people to pressure Congress to investigate this and change the risks, change the dangers.
Yeah, that's an amazing tale. And you talk about the dangers of the nuclear threat, and you write in the book very powerfully about how in 1961 you drafted top secret guidance for the Joint Chiefs of Staff on operational plans for general nuclear war. And you asked at the time, what would be the impact? How many people would be killed if these plans were implemented? Can you talk a little bit about why these plans are so dangerous, and actually how they're even more dangerous now with what we know about nuclear winter?
Yes, Eleanor, you asked me earlier what the dangers were, and I so far have just told you, in a general way, what my attitude toward them was. But very specifically, the plans then were very strange in the history of war planning. They called for an all-out attack on the Soviet Union and its allies and China in the event of any armed conflict with the Soviet Union alone, such as a dispute over Berlin or West Germany or Iran or various North Korea, wherever we might be fighting Soviet troops. Eisenhower's plan called for hitting every city in Russia and China as well, in the belief that the Sino-Soviet pact made China just as dangerous an enemy as Russia in any cases. So it called for killing, and I'll get ahead here a little bit, more than 100 million Chinese in a dispute that had been started with Russia. This, by the way, at a time aside from the horror, the very idea of killing 100 million human beings, obviously nearly all civilians, who were not in a fight with us at all, that was just part of the larger expectations, which were revealed by the Joint Chiefs in answer to a question that I drafted for and the president sent in his name to the Joint Chiefs, which was, if your plans, this plan, were carried out as planned, how many people would die? And the initial answer involved only the USSR and China, which is what I had narrowly asked. But since they did have an answer, did know an answer, and I extended that to say how many people in all would be killed. And the answer would be, they gave to the president without apology, was 600 million people from their attack. Now, that included 325 million people in the USSR and China, but another 100 million in East Europe, which we called, with reason, the captive nations, these satellites, which were basically under Soviet occupation, and another 100 million on top of that in neutral and contiguous territories to the Soviet Union and China, like Austria, Afghanistan, Finland, even parts of Japan, northern India. Third additional 100 million in West Europe, our NATO allies, without any warheads actually dropping in their area, but from the radioactive fallout from our plans, our attacks in the USSR and East Europe. That was the same effect with radioactive fallout that condemned the neutral countries in case of our attack. So the total, I repeat, is in the neighborhood of 600 million, which I read as 100 Holocausts. It's actually hard to comprehend a figure like that humanly, and certainly and hard to find language even to characterize plans like that. Our language wasn't designed, it seems euphemistic, in dealing with a prospect that simply was not possible in the rest of human history prior to 1945, or even later with the thermonuclear weapons in the mid-50s and later. So, nevertheless, this plan was essentially a first strike plan, that is, the first to be using nuclear weapons might have arisen out of a prior conflict with non-nuclear weapons in Berlin or elsewhere. It was a plan for us to be the first to launch nuclear weapons. It called for no reserves. All of our plan, when I said it was a very unusual plan militarily, that was not only because of this incredibly large number of casualties, you know, far beyond anything ever conceived before by Genghis Khan or Tamerlane or the First or Second World Wars. But it was also the nature of the plan was bizarre in that it involved simply trucking every weapon that we had with every vehicle, bomber, and missile that we had to the Soviet Union on predetermined targets, which included, as I said earlier, every city in the USSR and China, and most of the towns, anything over 25,000 people. But that only accounted for a small amount, fractionally, of the plan. Most of the targets were supposedly military targets, bases, missile sites, but many of those were in cities. So that even later, when Nixon and others said, well, we don't attack cities per se anymore, we simply attacked military targets in cities, which again would mean burning all the cities in that area with effects which we didn't know really for another 20 years. But there was also the fact that the president, Eisenhower, in order to avoid the possibility that our attack could be paralyzed by an attack on our communications or on Washington or other command posts, had delegated the authority to launch nuclear weapons secretly to his theater commanders, like Commander-in-Chief Pacific, where I was working on a research program for SINCPAC. and other commanders. And they had in turn delegated it for the same reasons to lower commanders in their command. Communications was out part of every day from between Washington and Hawaii, where SINCPAC was. And in those, at that part of the day, SINCPAC was in effect on his own. The same was true of our communications between SINCPAC and the 7th Fleet in the Western Pacific. In other words, there were many fingers on the button. There wasn't just one button. And that has essentially remained true ever since. Kennedy chose not to change the arrangements of what his subordinates called the great general, Eisenhower, who preceded him, and not to raise that political controversy. And other presidents did the same, essentially. Now, the system, we don't know in detail now, at this moment. It was true, as I've described, throughout the Cold War. But I think we can take it for granted, from my work in command and control, that no American president has allowed the possibility that our retaliation would to Russia would be paralyzed by an attack on Washington. And that means that it cannot and has not ever been the truth that only the president can launch these vehicles. That's almost surely true in other nuclear states as well. We know that it was true in Russia, and up to the present, it was even reconfirmed in the first month of Trump's administration just last year. And it's almost surely true in other states as well, including North Korea.
Well, I want to come back to this question of who has the authority to launch these deadly weapons, but let's stay on this question of how many people get impacted when the plan is implemented. So you talk about when you put that question to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they came back and said, well, we estimate 600 million people, as you say, 100 Holocausts would be wiped out. But then we learned in 1983 about nuclear winter. So the actual impact would be even far greater, as horrendous as 600 million deaths would be, that it would actually be far worse. Can you explain a little bit about what is nuclear winter and how bad it would be?
Yes, that was a major aspect of my book, to try to make people aware of what environmental scientists have concluded, first discovering it in 1983, about 35 years ago, but confirmed very thoroughly and even more ominously in the last 10 years. The 600 million figure was based actually on a, quote, conservative estimate, because it considered only the effects of nuclear weapons, of blast, immediate radiation, and fallout, much more extensive. Fallout meaning particles of earth, dust, blown up by the invasion, coated with radioactivity and deposited by winds over very, very large areas, thousands of square miles. They didn't even account then for the greatest single casualty-producing effect of thermonuclear weapons, which is fire. Mm-hmm. And they knew that was the main effect, but they said it was too hard to calculate, estimate in advance for judging requirements for weapons, how many they needed to destroy various targets, and other reasons. I think they weren't really interested in advertising just how destructive this would be. So they said that depends on winds, on flammable materials, and so forth. Too hard to calculate, which was questionable by the other scientists said at the time. Now you could calculate that too. But if you did put that in, that right away, with a world population then of 3 billion in 1961, that would have brought the casualties from our attack, not Soviet retaliation, but our attack, up to more than a billion, or a third of the Earth's population. But there was still an effect that was not looked at, and that was smoke and soot from the fires that these weapons would cause in cities. And what they realized in 1983, with a number of studies of Carl Sagan and Turco, Brian Toon, and others, about seven others, was that the key thing was that this smoke would be lofted by the thermonuclear explosions in firestorms created by the attacks, so-called firestorms, which create a very strong updraft into the higher atmosphere and above the troposphere, our main atmosphere where our weather is, into the stratosphere, where it would not rain out. And the smoke would persist up there and quickly go around the world within a matter of days, blotting out most of the sunlight. And by the way, the sunlight in turn would heat these clouds over time even further into higher, where they would persist, it's now known, for more than a decade. At first, the calculations could only look up to about a year in terms of the computer models they were using then. But now they know that it's more than a decade that this deprivation of sunlight would cause on the Earth's surface ice age conditions throughout the year, temperatures we haven't lower than we've seen since the last ice age, freezing lakes and rivers, but in particular, killing all the harvests worldwide. So without the sunlight, with much reduced sunlight, it would be like twilight at noon, or winter conditions, cloud conditions in the summer. Killing the harvest means that within a year or so, nearly everyone would starve. Not quite everyone, not probably full extinction, because there'd be some people, especially in the lower parts of the southern hemisphere near the Antarctic, that could subsist on fish and mollusks, and perhaps 1% of humanity would survive. Our population is now 7.4 billion. So 1% is over 70 million, a fairly large number of people, goes back to basically very early historic times or prehistoric times. It's not everybody, but civilization as we've known it, 99% of the people and all the cities and towns would have gone. And with them, nearly all large animals. They're not as adaptive as we are. They can't move thousands of miles to the to escape these effects. Or they can't build fires and houses, clothes, whatnot. They go extinct entirely. And this 1% of humanity would be left on an Earth with no other large animals. The key thing here is that we're talking now about killing 6 to 7 billion, or perhaps 7 billion or more humans from an American first strike. And the weapons that we have on alert, with cities they would actually burn, even if they weren't targeting cities per se, as they like to say, would still be burning the cities from military targets near the cities or in the cities, command and control, transportation, air defenses. They do target these. And a couple hundred of those does the job. In other words, the biggest effect in causing casualties, deaths, would not be any of these immediate effects or even the fallout that were being considered in 1961. It would be from the smoke lofted into the stratosphere. That would be true for Russia as well. So either of those effects could be called a doomsday machine, in the sense that Herman Kahn, my colleague at RAND, invented as a concept back in 1959 and 60, a system that for deterrent purposes had the capability, or would automatically actually, in his concept, kill everyone. Well, this would be close enough to everyone to be called a doomsday machine. And there are two of them on the Earth right now, possibly more, because even the other powers with thermonuclear weapons, Britain, France, Israel almost surely, China, and this is excluding North Korea, which doesn't have thermonuclear weapons yet, and India and Pakistan, which don't have thermonuclear weapons, H-bombs yet. All those three will get them quickly if testing resumes, which has been part of the Republican Party platform for some time, to resume testing. But if that should happen, for instance, if a conflict should emerge in Korea, if the summit agreement breaks down, or in some other occasion, Cold War heightens and the testing is resumed, they too will have doomsday machines. But two two is enough right now. One is enough to do us in. But two together are much more than twice as dangerous because they're on hair trigger alert. Each side has ICBMs that can survive attack only by launching before the enemy warheads arrive. That is, launch on warning. And both sides are set up to do that. The warnings have often been false. We've had a number of serious false alarms, an innumerable number of possible, you know, indications, like the Hawaiian one recently, by the way, which wasn't at national level, but was at the Hawaiian region. At the White House level or the North American Air Defense Command level, there have been, as I say, innumerable, by which I mean thousands of small incidents that might be an attack. But these are winnowed down by the warning process to more serious ones. And of those, there have been half a dozen or more cases where we had to consider seriously at high levels the possibility that we were under attack, which would lead, if it got a little more serious, more confident, to a launching of our ICBMs in particular, use them or lose them. The same is true in Russia. And again, in 1995, Yeltsin had his computer presented to him in which he was had to consider whether to give a go code because of a supposed missile on its way to Moscow. It wasn't on its way to Moscow. It was a Norwegian weather rocket that they had mistaken for a possible attack or a possible electromagnetic pulse attack, one that would cut off our communications, their communications. And in that case, he delayed long enough not to respond, long enough to show that it wasn't, in fact, going to explode over Moscow, or it would have already. So we were saved. We're still here. Humans have a sword of Damocles over their head, as John F. Kennedy put it back in 1961. This sword of destruction suspended by a thread. Actually, I think he had a horsehair. Depending on the prudence and the judgment of a handful of individuals who so far have not cut that thread. But that's the way we live. It does not indicate a bright future for humanity unless we change the system.
Right. Well, and you paint a very grim picture, but I'm afraid it's a very realistic picture about the potential impact of a nuclear war, and it's backed up now by environmental science, all of this concern about the nuclear winter that the fires from the nuclear blast would cause. And, you know, I was part of that 1980s movement to try and stop the nuclear threat. The peace yes. movement, the anti-nuclear movement is very, very strong. You know, we have millions of people out in the streets. And after Ronald Reagan left and after the Soviet Union dissolved, there was a real feeling that the danger had passed and people went on with their lives and stopped marching. But you have said two things that are critically important that we need to think about, and they relate to each other. The first thing you mentioned is about the potential of a false alarm, that there, you know, so much mechanical that could go wrong, and that could be misread by someone and trigger an alert. And combined with the threat of a false alarm is the fact that the ability to launch nuclear weapons does not rest in the hands of just the president. That actually is, you know, something we've been misled to believe, but that, as you mentioned, the authority to launch nuclear weapons has been delegated down. And talk a little bit about this this suitcase that follows the president, that we think it has to be a high-level, serious deliberation before the nuclear weapons are launched, and why that image is wrong.
Well, I think I've described earlier that all nuclear states face the question of how they can assure retaliation, even if the leadership is, in the American phrase, Pentagon phrase, decapitated, something we've been exercising against North Korea every year, by the way, destroying their leadership so as to paralyze any response by them. They almost certainly have made the same arrangement that we know the U.S. and Russia has made, that in such a case, if Kim Jong-un were killed, or if all of his subordinates are right around him were killed, nevertheless, there would be a retaliation. And the that's almost implicit in the idea that deterrence depends on getting off your most vulnerable weapons that are under, possibly under attack, in our case, ICBMs, as opposed to waiting out an attack and deciding on a response with by whatever authority is remaining. The military in neither the U.S. or Russia could really stand the idea that they would lose a lot of their weapons while leaders were deciding, and they've long had a very strong inclination to launch on warning, even when presidents had some misgivings about that. And neither the civilians nor the military have really wanted to worry the public with these deliberations. They're very secret and allow the possibility that so many people could actually launch these weapons. In other words, the impression the public has is that there is a lock on all the weapons with, in effect, the combination held, an electronic lock of some sort, like a padlock, that would lock up the weapons unless a signal is received directly from the president, as if the president alone had a code. And we hear about the codes in the briefcase that's carried around for the president, as if he alone could launch those. That is not the case, has never been the case, or virtually couldn't be the case. As they say, one bomb by a terrorist, even a non-nuclear bomb or whatnot, could eliminate many of the authorities that are involved. For example, in 9/11, a couple of the airliners could have wiped out on the Capitol and the Pentagon which was attacked, and the White House, even with non-nuclear weapons. The highest authorities for the launching these weapons, and it is not the case that would have paralyzed our response. In other words, the codes, such as they are, and there are locks at the lowest level on these things, are not held that high or that narrowly. So that's the situation in the nuclear era that we're looking at. People worry about Trump, and rightly so. And they ask, could he launch on his own? Well, constitutionally and operationally, yes. There is no provision for overriding a president's decision to do that, whatever happens. That isn't to say that that no one would raise questions or argue with him or debate whatnot, but in the end, he could make that decision. In the end, could be in a matter of minutes or seconds. And if someone resigned in the course of that, they could be fired and replaced very quickly. And the chain of command definitely includes the president and is at the highest level. So, yes, Trump can launch that. But is he the only one who can? No. And I don't know. People find that reassuring somehow. It just means he's not the only one. And by the way, there could very well be people below him in the system that are less stable. People may find that hard to imagine, but it's reality.
Yeah, it is hard to imagine someone less stable, but it is possible. And you mentioned about launch on warning. So I know during the high tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, we had that hair trigger alert. So basically, launch on warning was if we got any sense that the Soviets were going to attack us or something we thought was an attack, that we, the United States,
In answer to your earlier question, if I can also remember one point, you're saying what might, if I understood you, what might raise the likelihood of this, or when is it most dangerous, and the answer is during periods of, as you say, tension, hostility, conflict of various kinds, political or armed conflict, that's when the almost ubiquitous false alarms get taken much more seriously. Why did the Hawaiian alarm seem as realistic as it did to so many people in Hawaii, starting with the person who chose to put out the first alarm and the headquarters there? And the answer is precisely because we were and could be again in a state of imminent hostility with North Korea. It was imaginable that North Korea might have started this, even though there, you know, it wasn't an hour by hour reason for that, but they in turn might have seen the very explicit American hostility and misinterpreted it as an imminent attack and launched their weapons as well. In the 90s, when we were relatively almost contemplating alliance with the Soviet Union, or then Russia, the Soviet Union had disappeared. So the non-communist, now capitalist Russia was actually talking about wanting to be in NATO if NATO continued. And various Americans were very favorable toward including them in some kind of security arrangement. That was a time when a false alarm would have seemed just incredible. It must be a false alarm. Hard to imagine that it was real. In other words, we were relatively safe, even with the same weapons at that point. Even so, in 1995, as I said, Yeltsin was confronted with this possibility. And yet, we don't know exactly what was in Yeltsin's mind, but it must have seemed to him at that moment, you know, almost impossible. Why should the U.S. be attacking its now friend or, you know, relatively friendly country? So that would certainly have slowed Yeltsin's decision to act on that. But to take a contrast, in 1983, Andropov came to the conclusion that Reagan, who he thought was crazy, just as Putin, just who knows, there are those who can imagine that Trump is crazy. But anyway, Andropov thought Reagan was crazy because of his talk about the evil empire and apparent rhetoric about ending it. His actual actions he was taking, a tremendous buildup of first-strike weapons in the U.S., like now, under both Obama and Trump, and actions that he was taking to test Russian defenses at that point, the fact that there were exercises, as we were recently doing off North Korea, but have now been suspended. We were doing exercises looking at nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Under all those conditions, Andropov was on the alert, was highly vigilant for a possible imminent attack. And in the midst of that tension, in 1983, on September 26th, a colonel in the Russian warning and defense system, Colonel Stanislav Petrov, was confronted with his computer readout saying that there were 5 missiles on their way to the Soviet Union. Now, there was a condition where he knew that if he reported that as a real attack, and he wasn't sure that it was, because it was a new system and it was not being confirmed by other systems, but this satellite warning system was reporting that, he knew that if he reported that in that mood to his superiors, there would be an all-out preemption, a launch on warning, and we would not be here with nuclear winter, which by coincidence was just discovered that year. I don't know if he knew of it, but even that would have meant nearly all humans would have died. He may not have realized that, but he did know that the Northern Hemisphere would be devastated, and he chose to report it as a false alarm without being sure that it was. What I'm saying here is our survival depended on his judgment. Petrov's, and he's been described as the man who saved the world, and that's true. But somebody else in that same job at that time would almost surely have resulted with that evidence in the destruction of civilization. We are now approaching the kind of hostilities that were existing then. There's a new Cold War, a new suspicion of Soviet intentions, of Putin's intentions, which has a good deal of basis, but goes far beyond other explanations for Putin's behavior, or there's no question Putin is an authoritarian leader tied to corrupt oligarchs, and indeed rebuilding Russian nuclear weapons, modernizing his doomsday machine, just as we are. The atmosphere in which he's regarded as someone you can't negotiate with Trump being criticized for his plans to negotiate with Putin, that's an atmosphere in which a false alarm would be very dangerous. And I'm saying that that belief in an enemy that can't be negotiated with, which I suspect very strongly, not as an expert, is not the case with Putin. I believe it could well be that negotiations would be fruitful with Putin to reduce these dangers. But the atmosphere in which he's seen and Russia is seen as so dangerous that, but despite, by the way, in the context of what seems very strong evidence that he did interfere with our elections last year. Now, this is not to whitewash Putin or our relations with Russia at all, but the question as to whether that is a basis in which armed conflict would be justified, or an absolute isolation and lack of negotiations, I think is a dangerous response to that that definite intervention by Russia.
Right, and they interfered in our election in 2016, and there's nothing that's been done to stop them from doing it in future elections.
That's what I was just talking about.
Exactly.
That's what I was just talking about, yeah.
It could, you know, that is, creates the context where these weapons could be used, or a false alarm, as you say, could be misconstrued.
Yes.
So what can we do about reducing this threat? I know you talk in the book, I was relieved to hear you in the book say that we can dismantle the doomsday machine, and it's actually relatively simple and could be accomplished quickly. Tell us what we need to do to dismantle this doomsday machine.
Well, the vulnerable land-based intercontinental missiles, the ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, that are subject to being destroyed by a Soviet attack and are essentially only first strike weapons, which would not save any lives if they were used, because the exchange of submarine-launched nuclear weapons, which can't be targeted by either side, would be more than, unfortunately, themselves would destroy most life on Earth. So the ICBMs, whether used or not, would have no effect on the actual outcome in a matter of months when nuclear famine had gone its course. Okay, these ICBMs then are the trigger, the hair trigger to a doomsday machine. They've been anachronistic, unnecessary, obsolete for over half a century since there were submarine-launched ballistic missiles on both sides, which meant that damage limitation of a significant sort was really impossible. Counterforce targeting, it's called targeting of the enemy's offensive forces in order to reduce damage to your own forces. That's been infeasible since the untargetable sub-launched missiles on both sides would have this horrendous effect in any case. And yet we've maintained these missiles basically because it's profitable to make them. And they're made, parts of them, subcontracting in almost every state in the Union, certainly for the Defense Department as a whole, but even for these missiles, the effects of Lockheed and Boeing and Northrop and General Dynamics, their interest in producing these things and maintaining them, and now a new set of them now, which are budgeted for both by Obama and by Trump, is simply not only profits, but jobs, votes of unions, people, jobs depend on this, campaign donations very significantly, so that Congress is very much part of this process. When Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, his first draft of his speech referred to a military-industrial congressional complex, MICC. See? And somehow the congressional got cut off as a little too provocative to the legislature. But it's the truth. They're wired into this system that supports it, and that's undoubtedly true in Russia as well by now, especially now that they're a capitalist country. They make profits making these things. That's not a good enough reason for having on either side this essentially hair trigger arrangement, which pushes toward launch on warning and raises the possibility of war by false alarm. Or even if there's not a tactical warning of an incoming attack, any armed conflict raises in each the mind of each the possibility that this conflict may be about to escalate in a way that we will lose our vulnerable weapons. We'd better get them off before they or the command and control is destroyed. That's a suicide pact, virtually. Not just it's a suicide pact triggered by false electronic warnings, by conflicts anywhere, very, very vaguely defined circumstances under which it would be suicide. And, of course, we're not talking just about suicide, and we're not talking just about genocide. When we talk about deaths in the billions, you're talking not only multigenocide, but really something that a philosopher, John Somerville, called omnicide, the death of everything.
Yeah, it's really very grim. And the other description I read about in your book called self-assured destruction, or SAD, but it is omnicidal.
Our own attack, would cause our own death. That's
right, exactly.
Term used by environmental scientists Alan Roebuck and Brian Kuhn.
But you're saying that if we could dismantle all these land-based missiles, that we could essentially dismantle the doomsday machine, so it's not just like on such hair trigger alert that it would destroy life on Earth. Is that right?
It would. Yes, it's a little more than that. That would take away, especially if you got rid of them on both sides, which is definitely worth aiming at, and which has been discussed in the Pentagon and then rejected for, as I say, these essentially political reasons. Okay, there would still remain a huge excessive number of sub-launch missiles, again, aimed largely at military targets, which is totally anachronistic, which has no military real rationale in terms of saving lives. Well, we've got something like 1,000 sub-launched weapons. That's been reduced. That may be an exaggeration now, but it's more than 400. At any rate, 400 or 500 was earlier more than 1,000 weapons at sea, and on just one side, our side. Those, again, are far more than necessary to cause, far more necessary, when I say necessary to cause nuclear winter, when I hear myself saying that, it sounds funny to talk about it, necessity to cause nuclear winter. Well, it's
right.
an empirical effect. It's not a political necessity. No nation has ever needed a doomsday machine. They've just acquired it. They used to say the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absence of mind. Well, that's kind of misleading, but it's it's an escalatory process. And here, when you start the assembly lines and you build these things, and profits and jobs and political prestige, including avoiding challenges by your political rival party that you're being weak and indecisive and so forth, all of those have led to this enormous have created doomsday machines. Nobody has ever intended to have them, and yet we've had them for more than half a century.
Right, and we need to stop it. And did I read your book right? You say the major risks could be eliminated by executive decision?
Well, yes, the president could, in principle, subject in reality to many political obstacles, but in principle and in constitutionally, the president could decide to forego the so-called land-based leg of the so-called triad, which has been, as I say, anachronistic in the eyes of many secretaries of defense, and like William J. Perry under Clinton, and heads of strategic command like General Cartwright have called for eliminating the land-based ICBMs for years, decades even. The president could do that. He doesn't have to budget for them. Will Congress object? Yes, because jobs and bases in Minot, North Dakota, where some of the Minutemen are based, the community depends on the base being on alert, that is, having a maximum number of airmen assigned to it, air and women, manning it 7 days a week, around the clock, to blow up the world, essentially. Okay, the community would have to find other bases for support. That's been enough to keep it there all this time. So, yes, the president could do that. He could also go off, say, launch on warning, again, subject to great kickback from the services and others. But in principle, he's the commander-in-chief. Does that depend on a congressional action? No, it does not. But I say that isn't to say it would be politically easy. In fact, every president has shrunk from confronting the services and the military-industrial complex in the end. Even when they've made gestures in this direction, no president has had the priority of reducing these dangers that, let's say, Obama gave to health care, or even though he did want to move in this direction, but he didn't give it that kind of priority. Trump has a priority, let's say, various ones, sort of reducing taxes on the rich. That's the priority of his Republicans in Congress, but also of Trump, it would seem. Or let's say his wall, which he's still at. No president has given that kind of attention and concern to getting past the bureaucratic and political obstacles here and bringing this about, even though several have been very aware of the dangers of this. Jimmy Carter, for example, and even Reagan.
Yes, and the reality is that we can substantially reduce the risk with executive action. And the other thing that I found hopeful in your book was saying that the current danger of the doomsday machine could be eliminated without coming close to total nuclear disarmament or to abandoning nuclear deterrence. So I think that's important for people to know. We don't have to get rid of all nuclear weapons, but we do need to take the trigger off of the doomsday machine.
Probably most people in the nuclear weapons states, of which there are nine, support the idea of having a survivable capability to retaliate with nuclear weapons somehow to a nuclear attack. And this basic core notion of deterrence of nuclear attack has very wide support. And to say, for example, that they do support that and even regard that as quite essential. That has nothing to do with the maintenance of a doomsday machine to deter attack. I don't think there's anybody who believes that faced with any kind of opponent we can imagine or have ever seen with nuclear weapons, that it would be necessary to have the ability to destroy most life on Earth, which is what we have, and the Russians, and possibly some of the others. Or much, have 10% or less of what we have. But even so, they might have enough to come very, if not to total nuclear winter. Even India and Pakistan, without thermonuclear weapons, scientists have shown now in the last 10 years, have the capability to cause a famine with reduction of sunlight because of lofting of smoke into the stratosphere, a famine from destruction of harvests that would kill not everybody, but about a third of the Earth's population, about 2 billion people. Is there any real need, obviously not, or justification for a dispute over Kashmir between India and Pakistan, which is continuing and has been for years, to have the potential of killing by famine 2 billion people? How can we find any words for that other than wrong, immoral? You know, just why you can have less condemnatory words. Surely it's to be condemned, and yet their capability is just a tiny fraction of what a dispute between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine or Syria would portend for humanity. So we've got a situation here then where even if one of those a very large number of people who find nuclear deterrence of attack a capability for responding to it as legitimate, and I would say I'm in that category, in a transition period, which will probably be fairly long, to what is the longer run goal, I think, of eliminating these weapons altogether. And I think that has to go with eliminating the fears of attack, the likelihood of war and attack that has led to reliance on these weapons. And I think the international order has to evolve in that direction as a practical goal if we really are to survive very long. But in the shorter run, where none of these nations wants to leave their opponents with a total monopoly of nuclear weapons, and I think that's very reasonable. I would not want to see Russia having a total monopoly. Russia would not want to see the U.S. having a total monopoly. And I think those are both very sustainable positions, reasonable positions. That doesn't mean that the humanity has to live with, or that we have to live with, a situation where billions of people are at risk. And that's the current situation. That could be changed by leadership with a high priority on it. I must say that almost, but it would have in the end to have the support of their legislatures and their services and their people. In the end, I think, or not in the end, as soon as possible, we need a public awareness and a movement such as we've seen in the past in various causes against the Vietnam War, against nuclear weapon testing, and against in support of the Freeze campaign in the 80s. But also now, we see various people taking action, this as we speak, on immigration, rightly so. You know, popular resistance to wrongful executive policies. And I think that's very much, it's not only to be applauded, it's a very hopeful sign that people are using their rights and their democracy to act, to withdraw their support and to obstruct wrongful governmental policies. Well, the nuclear doomsday policies deserve that and need that kind of mobilization as much as anything else.
Absolutely right. Well, you once brought an end to the Vietnam War by telling the truth to the American people through the Pentagon Papers. Let's hope you can bring an end to the threat of nuclear weapons by telling the truth about the doomsday machine. That's all our time we have. Daniel Ellsberg, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Eleanor.
People are talking.